two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Nut Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today we want to talk about a concept called copaganda. Not propaganda, but copaganda. And in fact, it is the title of a book. We want to talk to the author. His name is Alec Karakostanis. He is a longtime civil rights lawyer. He's the co-founder of Equal Justice Under the Law. He has fought the American money bail system. He's published a book. He has an excellent newsletter of the title Copaganda. And he is joining us this afternoon. We were just talking off air and saying many of the concepts that you raised in your book and your newsletter are things that are very affirming. When we try to talk about police misconduct, police terrorism, police brutality, it's often kind of hard to pinpoint it because, as you point out in your book, the police have well-oiled PR machines. They're very media savvy, and they know how to twist things in such a way that the average person just can't quite get a grip, but you put all that to rest. So with that said, welcome to the show, and let's talk about the concept of copaganda. Is that a word that you came up with, or had it been in existence for a while?
Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to be here. I love talking about this stuff, and you're right. It's just so important because copaganda is all around us. It's everywhere, and it's important to understand it better so that we can fortify our minds against it. And no, I did not come up with the word. It's something that people have been talking about for a long time. I think it's maybe something that I've used a lot on social media, and I've used it a lot in the last few years, after the uprisings following the deaths of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and others. And I think it sort of has caught on in the legal world and in some other spaces recently because of the incredible amount of propaganda that we've been subjected to over the last few years in an attempt to reduce the energy in society for that we exhibited with the largest movement in the streets in American history in 2020. So I think more people are paying attention to copaganda, but it's not a new concept, and it's not something that I invented or anything like that.
How would you describe it for people?
I think copaganda has really three main functions. The first function is it narrows our conception of safety and narrows our conception of threat. And it narrows our conception of safety to things that benefit people in power. So, for example, copaganda generally has us afraid of poor people, of people of color, particularly Black people, of immigrants, of strangers, right? Even though the most consequential harms in our society are actually perpetrated by powerful institutions, by people with resources, and most violent crime and most sexual crime in our society is perpetrated by people who know each other. But copaganda distorts us. Copaganda has us afraid of the unhoused person that we walk by on the street, or afraid of the person standing next to us at Walgreens, or right? It totally distorts our conception of threat. So for example, you know, if you watch a lot of the news, you might be really worried about carjacking or home invasion or organized retail theft or something like that. But wage theft causes $50 billion a year of harm. So employers stealing the wages of low-wage workers costs about 5 times all the damage from all other property crime combined. Or
right.
Tax evasion is like $1 trillion a year. So that's mostly wealthy people. And it's about 60 times all the property crime that the police and the FBI calculate combined. Air pollution is about 100,000 deaths in the United States every year. So that's like 5 times all homicide combined. And you know what? A lot of air pollution, millions of instances of water pollution, air pollution are actually crimes as well. But you don't get seven or eight stories with mugshots of the company owners who spew toxic chemicals into the water and soil and air that our children are drinking and breathing and killing people. It's not treated as an urgent crime in the news. So that's the first thing propaganda does, is it has us focused only on some things that harm us and not on others. And then the second thing it does is, once it's narrowed our conception of threat, it wants us always more and more and more and more afraid. So every year for the last 25 years, polls show that people think crime is rising. But almost every single year for the last 25 years, crime has been declining, to the point where we now have historic, half century lows in police reported crime. So, but if you ask people about their own neighborhood, they're much more likely to be accurate. People are much more likely to say, oh, well, crime in my neighborhood isn't up, but it's up everywhere else. Because when you filter your perception of the world through the news media, it gets distorted. And
And I was going to say, then this is something that you really bring out in the book. One of the things that I think is remarkable is how you talk about the punishment bureaucracy, and maybe you can explain that. And basically, I'll use this word, this entire ecosystem that exists around this bureaucracy. I'll just kind of contextualize it, since you mentioned Walgreens. I think all of us were bombarded with images of, the guy in San Francisco went to Walgreens with a bag and put all this stuff in there. And then the headline goes, $93 billion in theft. And I'm thinking to myself, that homeless guy did not steal $93 billion, even if he had 50,000 people like him walking into Walgreens. And then, of course, Walgreens played it up and made it seem like, well, we're closing our store in San Francisco because it's just crime ridden. And then months later, we find out that Walgreens had planned to close these stores long before the guy walked in the store. But I bring this up because it seems like part of what I got from the book is that this punishment bureaucracy and this ecosystem seem to be able to give bad businesses and bad business decisions a scapegoat. Am I correct in understanding that? And can you add to that?
And it's so much worse than what you're saying.
Oh,
And
no.
so I think you're exactly right in your analysis, And I want to say a couple of things, because it relates, by the way, I should just say the third main function of propaganda, because it relates to what you're saying, is, once it gets us so afraid, it tells us that the only solution to all of our fears is more and more and more and more investment in the punishment bureaucracy. So even the bureaucracy's own failures, like police violence, are an excuse to invest more in it. So, for example, the stock prices of policing industry companies go up in the days after high-profile killings of black people. It's very important to understand that every solution, whether it's the retail theft that you're talking about, the solution Gavin Newsom in California after those Walgreens incident in San Francisco, hundreds of millions of dollars more investment in policing, prosecution, and punishment. That's like climate science denial, or like a modern flat earther movement. Like, the actual evidence is that interpersonal harm in our society is not affected by little tweaks in whether there's seven officers on patrol here or four officers on patrol there, or like in San Francisco, like, is the rate of prosecution of shoplifting 58% or 47%? Or is the sentence like 14 years in prison or 11 years in prison or 9 years in prison or 5 years in prison? What affects actual crime and violence and interpersonal harm in our society are big things like levels of inequality, levels of poverty, access to health care, access to safe housing, permanent housing, early childhood education. It's a huge factor. Exposure to toxic chemicals like lead in children, the levels of isolation and loneliness in a society versus the levels of human connection across histories, across societies now. The societies that have lower levels of harm and violence are the societies that are more equal, that care for people's needs. Like, it's as simple as that, right? Those are the things. And so what we saw in 2020 was a massive movement to focus attention away from investments in these bureaucracies, this punishment bureaucracy, and to try to talk about how are we actually meeting people's needs. And so then we saw this incredible series of moral panics, backlash in the news media, including the what I think of as the most effective of them, the Walgreens and CVS and the retail theft panic that you mentioned. There's that one video from San Francisco Walgreens of someone. It was actually kind of a cool video, very impressive shoplifting. The guy like hopped on a bicycle and like somehow biked out the open door of the Walgreens with all this stuff on his. I don't know if you remember that
Right.
video, but it got like
Yeah,
tens of millions of views.
that became the face of it. And as we found out, Walgreens was planning on closing the stores anyway.
Yeah, and not only it's important to say, it became the face of it, but in the 28 days after that video, there were 309 local news stories about that single incident across the country. Okay.
Wow.
In the same time period, there was not a single story about Walgreens' own wage theft from its employees, far more significant crime. Okay. So that's something that I call the volume of news. How much we're told about something affects how urgently we think about it. It affects how serious of a problem we think it is. So, for example, I pitch a lot of stories to newspapers and TV stations about rampant crimes and illegality committed by judges and prosecutors and police officers, like with the money bail system, where several hundred thousand people are illegally jailed, separated from their families and children and schools and homes and churches and jobs and pets, every single day, illegally, solely because they can't pay a cash payment that is completely and utterly unconstitutional. And it's a federal crime to intentionally violate someone's constitutional rights. And so when I pitch this story to news outlets, they'll say something like, oh yeah, that's really bad, but somebody else just wrote a story on the money bail system like a few weeks ago in this other city, and so it's not really news, we can't cover it. But can you imagine going to a reporter in Cleveland and saying, hey, can you cover this armed carjacking? And they say something like, well, a reporter in Phoenix already covered an armed carjacking like a few weeks ago, we can't cover that. It's just, it's
Right.
not how the news treats massive crimes and harms perpetrated by institutions that have power against people who don't have power. Those things
Right.
are treated as like a single investigative expose that might win the Pulitzer Prize, but it's not like, it's not like seven of the nine stories on your local news at night with like the mugshots of the people that are perpetrating it. You know what I mean?
Right. Out of curiosity, when you have pitched these stories and you write about this, and you go, hey, look, there's massive wage theft, and they tell you somebody did it 2 months ago, what's their response when you say, well, why are you in Cleveland covering the guy walking in Walgreens in San Francisco? Hasn't that story been covered ad nauseum? What's their response to that?
People don't have a great response, right? I mean, there's no really good answer for how the news right now is taking the millions of things that are happening the night before and deciding which 12 or 13 things to tell you about, right? But I've gotten some very interesting responses from news producers and editors who are actually thinking critically about this stuff. Some of them who have read my newsletter or who have this conversation with me will say, I never thought about it like that. It's really interesting. And part of the problem for us is that as news organizations, we're actually pretty cash strapped and resource thin. We don't have a lot, like our organizations are have been divested from. A lot of news are owned by, cost cutting private equity firms, or they're really struggling and they don't have a lot of reporters. Anyway, so a few producers and editors started telling me this, and so I started asking others, and it turns out that like a lot of this isn't because individual news reporters and editors have like some sort of like strong ideological support for the police. Now, as I write in the book, many of them do. So it's very important to
Right.
understand. Many of them do. And the people who own a lot of news organizations are very invested in propping up the policing and punishment bureaucracy. But many of them don't. And the reason this stuff happens is that it's more like bureaucratic, and it has to do with their workflow. The police make it so easy for them. Every morning, every afternoon, the police send them 14 or 15 stories. And they don't just send them little snippets of text. They send them video, they send them audio, they send them charts and graphs, they send them people they can interview, they can introduce them to experts. In other words, the police package and produce the news for them, and they make it so easy. It's not the same thing as like the people who test the soil in the playgrounds where your children are playing, or the nurses who are seeing all of the stuff that's happening in the community, in the hospital, or the teachers at the schools. They don't have multi-billion-dollar public relations budgets. So what if I, take, for example, Los Angeles, where I was just talking about the book, the Los Angeles sheriff alone has 42 full-time public relations off officials.
Right. Hold that thought for 1 second. Alec Karakassonis is our guest talking about Copaganda. The man has a newsletter, has a book, and you're about to jump into something that I think is extremely important. I want everybody listening to gather around, pull up a chair, because what you have to say here blew my mind away. And let me just kind of contextualize it like this. There are news outlets, there are radio chains. I'll use Radio One as an example. It's one of the largest black-owned radio chains. And I remember there was a report that said they went from 125 reporters down to four. And we've seen that mirrored. I worked at Clear Channel and some of these other places where on staff you had like two reporters, four reporters, and they had to cover the whole cluster of stations in a market. So we're talking about these huge conglomerates that shrank their news departments down to two or three or four people. And I think this sets the stage, which blew my mind when I read about police and public relations. The floor is yours, Alex.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that, because it's really important to understand the environment within which this news is being produced. It's one of, in many places, real scarcity. Now, there's many other reasons I talk about in the book for why places like the New York Times are also the greatest purveyors of this kind of misinformation and propaganda. But for local news, it's the police are able to produce so much of the news because they're the largest public relations force in most cities and counties. And like I was saying, the Los Angeles sheriff is a good example. He has 42 full-time PR people doing
40,
misinformation work.
42. That means they call you up in the morning and they go, if you need an expert for a car chase, we got you. Crime, they got you. They make people available. 42
They
for one
do
department.
so much more than that. They do so
Really?
much. And by the way, those are just the full-time people that we know about. There's the LAPD has another 25. So if you just take the top two police departments out of many dozen police departments in Los Angeles County, that's 67 full-time police doing that work. Okay. When I went to San Francisco, I testified a few years ago. The city, the Board of Supervisors was actually in the dark. They were trying to figure out how much money is our police spending on PR, because it's not something that most police departments even report in their budget. You have to do a lot of investigative and freedom of information work. And what the Board of Supervisors uncovered was really chilling in San Francisco. Not only did they have something like nine full-time PR people, including, the head of it was making like a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, but they had a full-time videographer whose job was to make glorification videos of the police. And at the time I was testifying a few years ago, they were like slowly behind the scenes, trying to get another full-time videographer. And the documents that were released to the Board of Supervisors were bone chilling in San Francisco, and it's indicative of what's going on all over the country. So not only are there police divisions that are preparing news stories for reporters and connecting them to experts and whatever, but there are teams that are going out on social media and spreading misinformation, spreading propaganda, spreading police talking points. And by the way, I'm just talking about the police department officially. I'm not talking about the same PR teams that, different PR teams at DA offices and mayor's offices. I'm not talking about yet the police unions or the police foundations, all of which have their own money for this. I'm not even talking about the private huge police consulting industry for PR. So often police departments will hire outside consultants as well. So I'm just talking right now about like the fully employed officers in the departments, okay?
So let me come back to this, Alec, because we're here in the Bay Area and we're hearing San Francisco go, oh, we have 2,000 police. That's more than San Jose, but they're saying they're short. We don't have enough. And I'm reading here that, and as you just said, they have nine full-time people. And I think you used the word, they don't call themselves PR folks, they call themselves strategic communication. Right. So nine people that walk around plus the videographer. And I bring this up because in this ecosystem, you have, at least that I counted, 15 different websites or IG sites that dedicate themselves to reporting crime. The most infamous of them is a Bay Area State of Mind and Oakland State of Mind, which we recently found was being funded by political candidates and all that. And you're sitting there going, how the heck did they get these clear videos of all these crime things? And then now you're realizing, like, oh, must be getting it from maybe the videographers and all this. So I'm sitting there going, that's how, these mom and pop operations are able to get close-up videos of crime scenes. It's not like they're running around, but they're able to take advantage of what these nine full-time strategic communication folks are able to deliver.
Beneath every news story, and beneath so many little Instagram or Twitter accounts that you think are some independent person, just some random community member, there is a bustling underworld of highly coordinated public relations work. But it's even deeper than that. What we found in the San Francisco documents and what I've seen in other cities is part of the job of these teams. It's not just what you think of as like traditional public relations. They have protocols where, in the wake, for example, of police violence, they have team members that have detailed instructions to intervene with and go and find immediately the family members of the people who've been harmed by police violence. They want to get to them before the media. They want to start shaping the narrative with them. They want to co-opt them, right? They want to get them on board the official police story. They want to prevent. This is a key concept for the police. They want to either prevent or stoke virality, because virality is everything in the modern social media world. If a story goes viral, tens of millions of people can see it, like the Walgreens shoplifting incident. But if a story doesn't go viral, almost no one will see it or remember it. And so when police are doing really, really bad things, they want to block virality. And that means sort of keeping the story down for a while. Like one of the most amazing stories was the Chicago police murder of Laquan McDonald, which the police had a video of this cold-blooded murder. If you remember, all the cops lied about it. They hid the video so Rahm Emanuel could get elected again. And finally, years later, a judge forced them to release the video. And when the Chicago police hid this, the idea was, we don't want this going viral. We don't want a situation like a Rodney King or a M Michael Brown or George Floyd, right? So they had four full-time PR officials, okay? But over the years, as the, after it got released finally, and there were a bunch of other incidents, the killing of the teenager Adam Toledo in Chicago. there was huge movement against the police in Chicago. There was the investigative reporting done about the black site places in Chicago. So the Chicago police understood not that they should change their practices, but that they had a PR problem. And so today, as you and I are talking, it's not four PR officials they have. They have over 50. And like so many of those people are actually like intervening in neighborhoods, in communities, fronting what look like community groups and things like and feeding information to key community allies. And so it's a much bigger ecosystem than you would than it's not just feeding news to like your local news producer.
One of the things that caught my attention was, I don't know if he's still the police chief of Houston, Chief Aceveda, but he was the police chief in Austin. And to your point about intervening, it reminded me of this incident that happened where somebody in Austin was shot while they were sleeping in their car, and it set off a firestorm. And there was supposed to be a community meeting. And I remember I happened to be out there at this time, and I went to this meeting with some local folks who were activists. And the first thing the chief says to me, he goes, "Davey D." And I'm like, how does he know who I am? I'm like, yes. He goes, "We're both California boys." And he's smiling and he goes, "This isn't California. This isn't Oakland. This is Austin." So that was chilling on to itself. And, this place is packed and everybody's ready, pitchforks are out. They want answers. And before anybody could really say anything, he goes, I'm going to say it's Singletary, but it might be a different name. He goes, "I talked to, the victim's father. We're going to pay for the funeral, blah, blah, blah." He was smooth as heck. To your point, he had already talked to the family. He's making funeral arrangements with them, all this craziness. And it threw everybody for a loop because, he knew everybody in the room. And I'm sitting there like, how did he know this? Now, we now know that he comes out of LA, which you point out is very sophisticated. But in your book, you highlight what he was doing in Houston, only to say that he seems to be a master class on propaganda and some of the things you talked about.
The police are so effective at shifting in moments, in the rare moment where the sort of they are forced to admit some kind of wrongdoing. They're very, very good at throwing under the bus one or two cops, the bad apples, and shifting things back to getting more resources. There's this really powerful scene, because I think most people know this, but George Floyd was actually had fled the Houston area to go to Minneapolis, and he had been harassed and arrested by the cops in Houston, and despite that history, leaving for Minneapolis, searching for a better life, et cetera, when he died, the Houston police did a number of, I forget all the things that are in the book, but I think they changed their profile picture online to like, a silhouette of George Floyd or something like that. They had a, procession and a, parade with his coffin for his funeral down in Houston, and all these things. And they had killed six people in the 6 weeks prior to George Floyd. And there had been massive corruption and brutality scandals going on at the same time in Houston. And Acevedo was, pulling down his mask and crying, at the George Floyd site. And it was this part of this wave of police. I don't know if you remember like the cops like kneeling with the protesters and doing the Macarena with pro like it was this there's a little funny anecdote in the book about the prevalence of police and saving baby duckling stories. So there are many, many, many dozens of strategically timed stories around the country about local police saving baby ducklings. And there's a whole world of of other kinds of police propaganda. So there's some propaganda is really obvious, and others is it's an effort to make the police seem like they really care, and that so you know there's the story that I have in the book about the sheriff who we're suing. I'm representing a bunch of children suing a sheriff who worked with a private equity telecom company to cut off family visits for children so they could make more money off really expensive for-profit phone and video calls, right? That
Right.
sheriff is separating children, and he's preventing children from hugging their parents. And I'm representing a bunch of children who are trying to establish a constitutional right for all children to have contact with their parents. And you know, there's millions of kids are prevented from visiting their parents in jails across the country because of this for-profit kickback scheme where the companies pay the sheriff's cut of the money. That same sheriff is out there in the George Floyd protest, putting down his weapon and saying to everyone, "I want to hug you," and offering hugs to the, you know, just down the street. He's preventing children from hugging people in his own jail, you know, and he's telling everyone that he loves them. And it's, to me, Acevedo and this other sheriff, they are really good examples of the gap between the image of the punishment bureaucracy and the reality of what it does to the most vulnerable and poor people in our society.
You know, Alec Karakatsanis is our guest this afternoon. You have a couple of other every chapter could be a book unto itself. I just want to say that. But can you talk about progressives want a pro-crime hellscape? I was just on the Nextdoor platform the other day, and I saw somebody say, "Oh, the people in Oakland, they're lawless, and they want a hellscape, the city of the hellscape." And I'm like, that's a strange word to be using. And here it is in your book. What's that about?
One of the themes of modern, you know, so contemporary propaganda is this idea that, well, progressives just love crime and they love disorder and they want everything to be really unsafe. I've actually been doing this work for almost 20 years. I've never met a person who's trying to make the system less brutal and less horrific and, you know, working on so-called reform issues, who wants more crime, right? It's a
Right.
very weird, and in fact, the policies that progressives are putting forward are scientifically and empirically proven to make our society safer. So it's like a modern form. This kind of propaganda is like a modern form of flat earther, as I was saying. You know, it's a total denial of reality, and yet it's pervasive. So the recent recall in Oakland is a great example. Or San Francisco, the recall. The policies that are proven to increase safety. By the way, you know, crime was down from the beginning of the tenure of Chase Abudin in San Francisco to the end of the tenure, right? So crime was lower when he left office than when he got into office. You wouldn't know that from this, you know, and the policies that he put in place, in terms of the treatment of youth, in terms of the bail system, in terms of prosecution priorities, they're like shown through evidence to increase safety and reduce future crime. So, but he's portrayed in the news media as sort of like desirous of more crime and loving criminals and things like that. And I go through in the book, I think, some really interesting and sometimes somewhat funny examples of like exactly how the news media does this and why they're doing it. And so you can kind of pay attention and sort of see for yourself, you know, how this is done. But one of the key things I want to mention here in the standard playbook, whether it's in New York when they're criticizing progressive city council people or in Oakland's recall or whatever, they do something very sneaky, which is they make the progressive person seem like some idealistic, naive, impractical person who just wants everyone to get along but has no real idea. And they do this by systemically erasing from the news the details of their really good policy proposals. So it sounds like progressives have no plan, You know, it's like it just sounds like, oh, all they want is, blah blah blah, but they don't actually have a plan to do it. I tell a story in the book about a profile that the New York Times did of a progressive black woman, city council person in New York. And they made her seem like she had no idea what she was talking about. They quoted all these people who were saying things like, "We have no idea what she's doing. We've never talked to her. Like she's not around. All this stuff, and like we have no idea what her platform is." And in fact, like you could just like go to her own website or go to any of her community meetings, or and she had like an incredible and detailed and beautiful platform of specific policies. And but if you look at the news, it seems like she's just some like random. Scoldy liberal person who doesn't care about anything and doesn't. So when you systemically erase from public view the specific evidence-based policies that progressives are proposing, people get the sense that they're not serious, that they don't care, that they're just bloviating, that they don't actually care about safety, right? Or if they cared about safety, they would tell us what they want to do. So that's just one example of many I give in the book. Of this theme in the news, which is that if you want to be tough on crime, you got to go with the authoritarian and conservative candidates, the candidates the police want. And by the way, those people who portray themselves as tough on crime, not only is that shown by the evidence to increase crime, which is why the more punitive states around the United States have higher rates of crime, right? But if you, those same people want to be highly impunitive with other kinds of crimes, crimes committed by the police, crimes committed by wealthy people, crimes committed by corporations. So it's not that they're tough on all crime, right? They're tough on the poorest people in our society, people with disabilities, immigrants, black people, et cetera, et cetera.
I know your time is short, Alec Kakistanis, but I got to ask you about the bad apple. That's a fascinating breakdown of how that whole thing works, a bait and switch type of scenario, and one that hides the systemic nature of what we're talking about. Can you kind of break down what you mean with the bad apple?
Absolutely. This is, I think, a really important chapter in the book. In the rare instances where police are forced to acknowledge some kind of misconduct, because keep in mind, most of the time the police are just deny, 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 right? It's unless they're like really forced with a video not taken from a body camera, because as I talk about in the book, body cameras, the police control them. They look outward away from the officer. It's very rare that a body camera will capture police misconduct in any kind of clear way. Except those instances where the police kind of forget that they're on and it catches them planting drugs on people. But the so you know the take the Eric Garner video or the George Floyd video where a bystander films standing away from the police is able to capture the kind of totality of what the police officer is doing and the whole situation. And in those rare instances where they're forced, they have sort of a hierarchy of preferences. Their number one strategy is to paint the problem as the problem of a bad cop, a bad apple. This is one of the main focuses over the last 40 years in the policing relations industrial complex and their role in Hollywood. The problems in policing in Hollywood are often linked to bad, corrupt individual cops. So when Spike Lee made Black Klansman, he was under a marketing contract with the NYPD. A lot of people don't know that. Yes, and it's very sophisticated, because it's part of a broader focus in U.S. Cold War propaganda dating back to the 50s to try to make everything good that happens the result of a hero and everything bad that happens the result of a villain and a bad person to focus the population away from systemic structural problems of society, like let's say the distribution of wealth or things like that. So the propaganda is one species of this general kind of originally Cold War propaganda tactic. But like in sometimes the police are forced, like let's say the Ferguson is a good example because when I got to Ferguson, in the wake of Michael Brown's killing before, and we did a huge investigation into Ferguson, and we were the first groups. My organization, Civil Rights Corps, and Arch City Defenders, and others filed a landmark lawsuit against the Ferguson Police Department after Michael Brown was killed. It turned out that the city of Ferguson averaged 3.6 arrest warrants for every household, and almost all of those arrest warrants, and all of this is according to the lawsuit that we filed, and which has now been finally been settled for those families and people, but almost all of them for unpaid debt. So many cities in the United States had converted their police departments into municipal debt collection, and so sometimes the police will be forced, like after the Rampart scandal in LA or Ferguson, to sort of portray it, well, okay, this one precinct is really corrupt, or there's corruption at this police force. So you see this happen sometimes, like when the mayor or the governor will say, okay, we need the DOJ to come in and do a consent decree. So I spoke in Seattle last night. The Seattle police are under a consent decree, and the Baltimore police are under a consent decree. And there's this idea that, okay, well, the problems here, okay, maybe we have to admit it's worse than a bad apple, because there's been multiple incidents of this with different cops. Oh, you know what? Like, there's been year after year after year of this here. Okay, you know what? This particular precinct has a problem, or this particular police department has a problem. There's this hierarchy of kind of bad apple framing, instead of really deeper social conversations about, well, what is the role of police in a highly unequal society? What is their actual job? What is their function? And linking that to the history, right? Police were established to catch enslaved people who ran away and to crush laborers who were striking in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century. It wasn't until the second half of the 20th century that they started marketing themselves as really, public safety, right? They had to switch their kind of framing. And so, to avoid really deeper conversations about the role of police in things like real estate development and gentrification and preserving and protecting inequality and managing the lack of mental health infrastructure and healthcare infrastructure and housing infrastructure and addiction treatment infrastructure, we have to like have these kind of conversations about whether individual cops or precincts or even departments are bad and need more resources for training and things like that. Instead of asking questions like, well, why are the police in this neighborhood and not that neighborhood? And why are they enforcing these crimes and not those crimes? And how are we defining what is a crime and what kind of conduct that causes a lot of harm is actually not a crime in our society? And so they want to avoid deeper conversations like that. And that's what the whole bad apple conversations are all about.
Very fascinating and very thorough work. Alec, I know time is short. How can people get a hold of your newsletter? And, are you going to be back in the Bay Area anytime soon?
I'm going to be back at some point soon. I'll always come where enough, people are interested. I can always, make a trip, and I love coming out to the Bay. And I just want to say, this book, none of the royalties go to me. All of the royalties go to charity. They go to an incredible organization, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, which works with unhoused people in Skid Row in Los Angeles, but does work relevant to fighting police surveillance and repression all over the country. Incredible organization. And also, as with my other book, Usual Cruelty, we have a charitable fund that people can donate to. And that enables us to get free books for any teacher in high school, college, law school, grad school who wants to have their students read the book. And we free copies for anybody in prison. So if you work at a books to prison program, we give you free books and you can send them into prisons. And the goal here is not to make any money off this, but to get these ideas out there and to encourage people to. And the whole last chapter of the book is about what we can do about all of this together. And so people can find me at Equality Alec on social media, and also my Alec's Copaganda newsletter is on Substack. But also, I encourage you, go out and get the book. And if you can't afford the book, write to us, and we'll come up with something, because I don't want money to be a barrier to getting these ideas out there. And if you do get the book, you'll be supporting really amazing organization that works with the most vulnerable people in our society.
Alec Karakostanis, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Thank you for dropping these pearls of wisdom, piquing our curiosity, and as I said at the start of the show, affirming something that many of us were kind of thinking, but just didn't have the information, languaging, or the words. You were able to fill those gaps and kind of have people go, yeah, I knew something was happening. I knew something wasn't right. And so you really, give a boost to that sort of thinking that people had but just couldn't really bring together. So we appreciate you. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.